It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if the Brewers Stadium can't be called Miller Park, what should it be named? We'll hear a case for honoring arguably the greatest player to wear a Milwaukee uniform.
First, Wisconsin's employment indicators are pretty strong. The unemployment rate is near an all-time low of 2.9%, and the labor participation rate is just over 68%. Those are both better than the national figures.
But a number of factors can hinder participation in the workforce, including things like training or education mismatches, health limitations, and a lack of transportation. A new report details how access to affordable, reliable, high-quality childcare can affect labor participation, especially among women.
In addition to workers and employers, the report also lays out the benefits of good childcare options to children and communities. And it describes how various local entities in Wisconsin are working together to find solutions to improve childcare.
Tessa Conroy is an economic development specialist and an assistant professor at UW-Madison and Extension. She's the author of the new Windicators report, Childcare as an Economic Development Strategy. Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, can we start to quantify how big a role childcare plays when we look at Wisconsin's workforce?
I think we can start to quantify it. When we look at labor force participation, particularly among women of prime age, so that's from 25 to 54, kind of the meat of our labor force, we see that for women, their labor force participation is noticeably below that for men, and that happens to also coincide with the years when a lot of families have young children. So it's not surprising to some extent that we see, you know, women aren't in the labor force at the same rate during those years, and we can think about how childcare, if they had it, if there were a good option, would some of these women prefer to work some amount?
And one of the striking things in your report was a map showing availability of childcare compared to the number of children who might need it. Can you talk about what you found?
Yeah, so that's just one way to try to understand, you know, where might there be strain in the state in terms of families trying to find childcare. So what we've done is take the total number of childcare establishments, keeping in mind that the large majority of those are these small kind of non-employer childcare providers, so maybe just one person, for example. That makes up about three-quarters of our childcare businesses. But in total, we take those childcare businesses and then compare that to the number of children. And we see that there's a lot of variation across the state. Some places seem to be doing okay. They have, you know, as many as 12 children per child care provider. In other places, it's much higher, closer to 50. And this is, too, just the formal child care providers, just the businesses. I know, of course, that there are a lot of informal child care arrangements happening, too. But I still think this helps us understand where might there be strain, where might families be having a hard time finding child care.
And that chart, that map just shows child care providers, period. It doesn't look at affordability. It doesn't look at quality of that child care, right?
Right. That's just, you know, to some extent, quantity of child care is just kind of getting your foot in the door in terms of how complicated this issue is. Certainly affordability and quality are very important, too.
Now, I know a lot of parents have probably been in this situation at some point where they ask the question, given the cost of childcare, assuming they can find it, given the cost of childcare, is it worth it to work or to work full time, right? Is that something that calculation, something that keeps people out of work?
Of course, I think a lot of families, a lot of parents are doing that math on a regular basis to, you know, does it make sense for me to work? Is my entire paycheck going to be going towards childcare? So, you know, we're finding in Wisconsin, and these are, you know, some relatively, I would say, conservative estimates that it could cost, for example, upwards of $1,000 for one child in childcare and weighing that against what your income is. So some households, for example, you know, it could be easily spending 15-25% of their monthly income on childcare. So, you know, that's, for some people, that might be comparable to what they're spending on housing.
We're talking to Tessa Conroy with UW-Madison and Extension. She has a new report out on childcare, childcare and employment in Wisconsin. And Tessa, are we in a double bind when we're in a tight labor market? We need more people in the workforce, but also we may not be able to hire enough people to provide the childcare.
Yeah, that's a good point. I imagine that childcare is facing kind of the same challenges in terms of finding enough people. So you make a good point that, you know, this is not an easy problem to solve. I think if it were, we'd have an answer already.
you in your report look at the benefits not just for parents themselves if they get childcare, but for businesses and communities. Can you talk about that a little?
Right. So I just wanted to highlight that this isn't just about parents. I think that they're a big component when we're talking about childcare, that there may be people who want to work some amount and childcare is getting in the way of that. So it's certainly good for workers, but this can also be good for employers. Employers are trying to find workers right now, so this can help them get workers in the door. It can also potentially save them in terms of retention. So if they're not losing employees, they're not having then to spend on hiring, they're not having to spend on training somebody new. So this can be good for employers in that way. Also presenteeism. So when their workers come to work, if they have good childcare, I think they might be a little bit more focused. Their stress levels are a little bit better. So presenteeism is part of the equation as well. Childcare is also a setting for early childhood development, so this can be good for kids. We've seen some research showing that this is good in terms of their long-term performance at school. This is good in terms of propensity for crime, and ultimately, you know, strong workforce, a strong business sector, having kids doing well, that's all good for community development as well.
So if we have this need for childcare, who does it? Who needs to take the lead on making it happen?
I think that'll be different in every community. What I'm hopeful of is just demonstrating that there are lots of people or lots of parties who have something to gain in finding a solution. So some sort of collaborative effort might make sense in a lot of our communities.
You, in your report, touch on at least a couple communities that have tackled this problem of providing childcare. Can you talk about what you found?
Yeah, so one example in particular, if I'm remembering correctly, Vernon County, they have Organic Valley, they have Vernon Memorial Healthcare, they have a partnership then with Medical College of Wisconsin with some grant support. So what they've done is create shared services so that childcare providers, for example, can all use one bookkeeper so that that's more affordable to have this shared service together. So that helps these childcare businesses be a little bit more sustainable. They've also come together to have some backup plans in the instance that a childcare provider may not be able to provide service for a particular day. There's a backup plan so that parents, for example, can still get to work so that they have a plan B if they need it for their childcare.
Now, here in Wisconsin, we were at the forefront of a welfare to work movement 20 or so years ago, maybe a little more than that. Is the lack of childcare, though, something that can hamper that kind of program, make it more difficult for parents, maybe moms, to get into the workforce if, again, this childcare isn't there?
I think it's true for a lot of families across the board that childcare, not just mothers, but I think more and more we're seeing, you know, kind of gender norms evolve, and that anybody who's in a caretaking role of a child, that's a major concern when they're trying to figure out what is going to be their work situation and how they're going to manage all of their responsibilities. So I certainly think that this is relevant in a number of contexts.
We're talking about a new report on the link between childcare and employment here in Wisconsin. Tessa Conroy is with us. She's the author of that report, an economic development specialist and assistant professor at UW-Madison and Extension. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Has access to high-quality, affordable childcare kept you from working? If you're an employer, has a lack of childcare nearby, kept you from finding the workers you need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're talking about how childcare affects the local and state economies with Tessa Conroy. She's an economic development specialist and an assistant professor at UW-Madison and Extension. She's also the author of the new Windicators report called Childcare as an Economic Development Strategy.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important is high-quality, affordable childcare to you? Have you been in the situation as a parent where you have to decide, is it worth it to work when you're weighing the cost of childcare or maybe cutting back to part-time or no time? If you're an employer, how big an obstacle is childcare for you? Does it make it difficult to keep employees? Does it hurt presenteeism, as our guest was saying earlier? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Tessa, your report includes charts on women and men and how much they participate in the workplace. And you see, if I'm reading this right, you see women dropping off in those prime years when they're maybe likely to be having kids. If I read it right, at least some of them are not coming back into the workforce. Is this something that affects women's careers all the way down the road?
Yeah, there is some evidence of that, you know, that once they leave, it can be hard to get back in the door, or that the kind of accumulation over time in terms of lost experience ends up hurting their prospects down the road. So it does seem to be the case, you know, kind of up until about 25, women and men are participating in the labor force at about equal rates. But as women kind of, you know, get into a time of life when they're potentially child rearing and having kids, having young kids, we do see them leave the labor force and, yes, not come back, even as those kids maybe get older and those same needs aren't as pressing.
Now, your report is about childcare as an economic development strategy, and you talked about what they were doing in Vernon County. Do you think that a local community or maybe group of communities, if they got together some kind of child care system, whether it's public or private or a combo, whatever, that that's something that could lure employers and employees to a community?
I think so. Like I said, I think there's something to be gained for both workers and employers among, you know, alongside kids and communities too. So I think that for workers thinking about kind of how do I juggle my responsibilities at home as well as my responsibilities at work, I think for employers thinking about, you know, I want to locate in a place where I have labor available to me, I think that there's potential for a community to use childcare as a strategy to get both employers and workers, you know, attracted to want to come live there, to want to come put their business there.
When we talk about economic development strategies, a lot of times it's about tax incentives or infrastructure, things like the roads and internet. It might be about the creative community. We hear about that some. Is this childcare issue under the radar?
Maybe a little bit. I think more and more people are talking about it, though, definitely. I do think this is an important piece of placemaking. I do think that with the labor market the way it is, and, you know, during the recession, for example, there was a lot of available workers. Now it's more the case that employers are having to compete for workers. So we're thinking about kind of where do workers want to live? What kind of amenities do they need? What kind of support do they need? What other than wages can we do to attract new workers? So I think childcare, because of that, is, you know, bubbling up as an important issue.
But does that only stay an important issue when we have a tight labor market, when it comes to a time when there's higher unemployment and it's then employees competing to get those jobs from employers? This maybe isn't going to look like such a priority?
I think for families, it's important all the time. I think this labor market, you know, is creating maybe some circumstances where more people are seeing it.
We are talking to Tessa Conroy from UW-Madison and Extension. She's an assistant professor and an economic development specialist, talking about her new report on child care as an economic development strategy. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Has the availability of child care or lack of child care affected you and your job hopes and dreams, or you as an employer? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Glenn is with us in Heartland. Glenn, hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Glenn?
Well, I think this is a great topic, and you know, it's something that's needed, especially if you want to recruit and hire staff. So our district is moving forward with investigating having a daycare that's primarily to attract new teachers into the district and retain our teachers, because we know that how stressful it can be to be a parent with little ones. So we're in the process of doing that. And it's also another piece to that is, besides having affordable health care, is that when it's something that the employer is involved in, it also builds collegiality among the staff, because Your colleagues also have kids in the same daycare, and it makes it more of a community feeling.
And Glenn,
it's also available to the community as well.
And Glenn, what's your position at the school district?
Superintendent.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. So there you have it from somebody who's got some employment decisions to make, a school district superintendent, Tessa. Is that something, I guess I was thinking about, you know, a government entity or a private business, but, you know, a public entity like a school district might do something like this.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Again, you know, and they're so close to not only having a workforce, but they have a lot of children right there, too, for example. So it makes sense, I think, for this school district to have an active role in solving this problem. So I'm encouraged to hear that solution.
Glenn, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tessa, we heard what Glenn's district is doing. You talked about Vernon County. It may be that there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to this, right?
I would agree with that. I think that every community probably has different stakeholders that are going to want to be part of finding the solution. They might have employers of different sizes who have different, you know, ability to get involved in this issue. I think your local leaders, to what extent, you know, they're seeing this as a community issue, for example. I think all of those factors are going to play into who comes to the table to work on this.
Do you see room for more state investment? Is this something you'd hope to see support for childcare, say, in the state budget we're watching for pretty soon?
I think there's an argument to be made for that because there are these benefits across the table. You know, it's not as though this is only benefiting parents, but because there's a lot of people, there's the employers, the workers, the kids, the communities, that maybe there is an argument for the state to be more involved in supporting child care.
As we wrap up, Tessa, what are you hoping your report accomplishes?
Again, I'm hoping that, you know, people see this kind of multifaceted issue. I know it's not simple, but there are many people who have something to gain by working at it. So I'm hoping to bring more people to the table so that some collaborative and creative solutions can be addressed.
Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tessa Conroy is an economic development specialist and assistant professor at UW-Madison and Extension. Her new report is called Childcare as an Economic Development Strategy.
Coming up after the news.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a musical poem.
January is National Polka Month. And what better place to commemorate this iconic sound than in Wisconsin, where the polka is our state dance. To celebrate, poet Susan Fearer shares a poem about her sister's accordion and her mother's irritation. It's called 1956, the year my sister, using her ill health once again, blackmailed my parents into an accordion.
My mother even hated the name of the store where she had to pick it up. Low Duca Brothers. She waited until dark to smuggle it from our old holiday trunk into our house. To my mother, the accordion was an immigrant, one of my father's relatives, one that didn't speak English, one that was pierogi fat that wore a babushka and anklets to church, one she thought she had talked him out of writing to. My sister would go out on my parents' suburban front lawn, between the maple and chinaberry tree, on the even, green, Bay Ridge, well-watered lawn, and practice Lady of Spain. My mother imagined the clouds above her house taking Lawrence Welk cutout shapes at Rankolaki's. Frankie Yankovic was at her door. The neighbors knew. My mother hoped my sister would abandon the accordion as quickly as she did her charm school, her twirling, her water ballet and Mamie Eisenhower scrapbook. My mother dreamt the six fat Dutchmen heard all about her sick daughter and came and taught her the two fat polka. All my father's unrecognized relatives came from Czechoslovakia to see the six fat Dutchmen and do the Slovenian twirl in twilight under plastic electric Chinese lanterns strung around my parents' newly landscaped suburban lot. My mother bribed my sister away from her accordion with a trip to New York to visit Uncle Jack, a professor who taught labor relations at Cornell. It was what my sister wanted all along. The accordion was her wardrobe door to Narnia, New York. While they were gone, The accordion sat alone as the night convent of St. Mary of Częstochowa. The accordion had rows of knobs of wonderful black buttons. I wasn't big enough to carry it. It was beauty. I imagined it vast and pearl as a confessional, gay as a polka fest. I sat next to it. I heard my sister's silent accordion stop playing the past. It began playing music I didn't know yet. Years later, I'd call it Zydeco and dance to it on sweet, full summer nights on side city streets of the future with holy card beautiful men who loved nothing more than a woman with an ear for a good accordion and all the musics one can make.
Susan Fearer is the former poet laureate of Milwaukee and the author of many books, including Milwaukee Does Strange Things to People. And if you want more accordion in your life, check out Wisconsin Public Television's recent story, Accordion is All in the Family. It's about lifelong accordion player Ruth Marty, her bandmate and granddaughter, Sarah, and an annual concert they host in New Glarus. You can find that story at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up after the news, our guest says with the Miller Park name on its way out, the Brewer Stadium needs a permanent name that everyone can raise a glass to. We'll talk with him about his idea and ask what you think. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Coming up, we'll talk to a lawmaker who says he's disappointed but not surprised by changes to the Foxconn development in southeastern Wisconsin.
First, when the news came out that in a couple of years the Milwaukee Brewers would no longer call their stadium Miller Park because of a new naming deal with American Family Insurance, some fans got upset.
For example, a West Alice Alderman tweeted, "Imagine Lambeau Field renamed Schneider International Field. I love your Brewers, but I'm pleading with you to keep Miller Park on the stadium."
The deal with Miller Coors, which has been in place since the stadium opened in 2001, runs through the 2020 season. A new name has not yet been announced, just that American Family will be the sponsor.
Company CEO Jack Swalswell told WISN-TV in Milwaukee that he knows this is a touchy issue.
There's some thought of shortening the name to AmFam.
AmFam Field.
Or stadium or whatever. And so I think we're letting our marketing team, giving them the autonomy to just run, you know, do the focus groups, get the data behind it, and then let's sit down and let's look at what that is. And then let's meet with the Brewers, make sure it's palatable for them.
What's your reaction? Call 800-642-1234. Are you sad to see the Miller Park name go, or does it not bother you? What should the stadium be called? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Our next guest says it's time to come up with a permanent name. George Stanley is the editor of Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. George, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Darrell. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, George, for spending a few minutes with us. So, first of all, what's your idea?
Well, I know that American Family is buying the name, and that's fine. I realize the Brewers need that revenue. But 25 years ago, before the new stadium was built, I really thought they should come up with a permanent name like Lambeau Field, and suggested in a column back then that they name it after Hank Aaron. And I still think there's room for that. I think it would be a great goodwill gesture by the Brewers and American Family if they called it something like American Family Field at Aaron Park or AmFam Field at Hank Aaron Park.
Now, obviously, naming it after Hank Aaron, certainly not many people would argue with that. But, of course, you'll probably hear some folks who will say, why name it after Hank Aaron in particular and not, say, maybe Robin Yount or Bob Uecker or Bud Selig or another huge figure in Brewers history?
Yeah, the only other name that people have been sending me notes and voicemails and things about it's been Bud Selig. There is a lot of support to name it after Bud Selig, thinking that, you know, he's the person that really brought baseball back to Milwaukee, and he's the reason we have that stadium. That wouldn't bother me either if it was something like American Family Field at Selig Park. But I think a person like Hank Aaron, as much as he's in the Hall of Fame and things like that, I still think he didn't really get his due for how unbelievably extraordinary his career was. When I looked at Christian Yelich's numbers and what a great season he had last year, the undisputed MVP, and he's 27 years old, and he'd have to play another 18 and a half years, and that all have to be just as good as last year was for him just to start tying Hank Aaron in his numbers. That's how good Hank Aaron was over a long, long period of time, playing more than half his career in Milwaukee, you know, starting with the Braves, bringing them a World Series, and then coming back to play with the Brewers to end his career.
George, you were pushing for a permanent name when the talk of new stadium, was coming up about 25 years ago. Why is a permanent name so important?
I just think you can see it right now in the emotion people are feeling at the loss of Miller Park. And then there's the additional complication that we named a road right next to the stadium after the ballpark. So there's Miller Park Way. And so it just seems to me that there should be some permanence there. When you think of the great stadiums, Lambeau Field, Wrigley Field, Fenway Park, that's what they are, and they're the ones that last. And I really think that for more, not just to honor Hank Aaron and not just to have a place that we know the name of and that name's going to stay and names are important, but it'll also be a statement for generations to come that we built a stadium to last, and we're not going to tear this down in 30 years and build a new one at taxpayer expense like we did the Bradley Center in downtown Milwaukee, you know, whenever something seems like it's obsolete because it doesn't have enough luxury boxes or whatever kind of seating arrangement brings in the most money in the future, that we're going to keep our stadium like they've kept Fenway in Boston and Wrigley in Chicago and Lambeau in Green Bay.
George Stanley is the editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we are talking about the decision for Miller Park to step away from their naming rights to Miller Park, and now American Family is taking over beginning in 2020. And we're asking you, what do you think about naming the stadium, maybe renaming it Hank Aaron Park to go along with American Family? Is there another name that you're thinking of that would be great? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Give us a call. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org, and you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer. Good afternoon, Deborah. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I thought about it, and I'm thinking, what's more important, the player or the people who pay for the people to play? And I decided people will play baseball for free. I mean, people will just be playing baseball forever. And so the most important thing, I guess, is the baseball player and then the person who sponsors them also. So I think your guest, the editor of the newspaper, is on the right track. Name it after both the player and the sponsor.
Deborah, thank you so much for the call. George, how much support have you heard for your Hank Aaron idea?
I've got a ton of support from readers. So a lot of folks have written in and saying, yes, I agree, let's do it. So that's mostly where I've heard the support from. I haven't really, talked to any public officials or been in that arena at all. So I haven't heard from American Family or anybody there. I did hear from an executive who was a top marketing official at a major company who said he thought that American Family could actually benefit by associating itself with Hank Aaron. He didn't think that was a bad idea for them either.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. Good afternoon, Mike. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. Like I said when I talked to the screener, it's just a name. I think people are getting too nostalgic over what the stadium is named. After all, Miller Park, that's after a brewery. So, you know, if you look across the country, every stadium that's got a name usually has got the name of the sponsor of the stadium. We're going to be watching the Super Bowl down in the Mercedes Stadium this weekend. So I think it's probably going to be rightfully so named American Family Park, whatever, or something like that. Hopefully it's not too long of a word. And that's just the way it is. And, you know, I don't think there's any sense in even talking about making it named Henry Aaron Stadium or something like that. After all, he played here for a few years, and that stadium's long gone. The other thing is, too, look, we've got Fiserv Arena. What the heck is Fiserv? So that's just the way it works. Companies who sponsor, who pay for these things, they have naming rights.
Mike, thank you so much for the call. And George, you know, as Mike said, you know, some people feel it's just a name. However, there has been a lot of reaction to this. American Family says they're not surprised with the initial negative reaction, but you know, they've said it's balanced out since then as people learn about the company and its plans to open up an office in downtown Milwaukee. So how surprised were you by the negative reactions to this?
I wasn't surprised because I think names are important to people. I think that there's been a lot of talk over the years when they remodeled Lambeau Field and spent a lot of money doing that. Should they sell the name? And the Packers got so much feedback. No, you better not. You know that they said no. It's always going to be Lambeau Field. We're not going to put a corporate name on it. But there's been other cases where people have had corporate names and added it to the traditional name of the stadium. So, for example, there's Capital One Field at Maryland Stadium, where they kept the name of their football stadium, its traditional name, but they did add a corporate sponsor. And there's nice sounding fields like Oriole Park at Camden Yards. So I think there's room for adding a permanent name to the mix, along with the one that might change every 15 or 20 years.
Let's go back to the phones. We have a few minutes left, but I want to take at least one more phone call. Let's go to Mary in Eau Claire. Good afternoon, Mary. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi, thank you. Just one quick comment. If they decide that they need to stick with the sponsor, American Family Insurance, how about just shortening it and making it more family-friendly by just calling it Family Stadium?
Mary, thank you so much for the call. And American Family did say they were going to take time for public input and plans to test potential names. A company spokesman said that it's not going to be, you know, 5 or 6 words long. Aside from your Hank Aaron idea, any other advice for American Family when it comes to picking a name?
No, and I don't think it's my, you know, it's, I'm not trying to tell anybody anything to do. That's not really my job. I just want to get the discussion going and see what people thought. I'd love to see it have a permanent name. I'd also love them to change the name of the road to a permanent number so that the businesses don't have to change their names every 20 years, and we don't have to change our street names and our maps every 20 years. So if and Miller Coors did not pay to name Miller Parkway, so I think maybe they should at least name that permanently, even if they're going to change the name of the stadium every 20 years.
We have about less than a minute left, so I wanted to ask you, how hopeful are you that the Brewers and American Family officials name the land the stadium is on and the road next to it after Hank Aaron?
Oh, I just think it would be really nice, and I think that all bask in the glow of it. I think American Family is a great steak company with a great straight tradition, and it sells all over the state, and it always has. And I think that by associating themselves with someone like Hank Aaron, it would do them a lot of good too. That's just my own opinion. Their marketing team will figure that out. But I remember, people in Wisconsin remember those types of gestures. Senator Herb Kohl, before he was senator, he saved the Bucks from leaving Milwaukee by buying them and keeping them here and then finding a good owner eventually. And people never forgot that. He was a very popular figure, even though he was a senator, and senators aren't always that popular. But people remembered how he saved the Bucks. And so I just think that companies and things like that can benefit from that type of association.
George, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Darrell. I appreciate it.
George Stanley is the editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him about why he says the Brewer Stadium ground should be permanently named after Hank Aaron once the Miller Coors name expires in 2020.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, a new survey by the Pew Research Center finds that 58% of Americans feel that the news media doesn't understand people like them. We'll look at those results and ask what you think.
Now, news broke yesterday that the Taiwan-based Foxconn Technology Group had reconsidered its decision to build LCD screens at the plant it's building in Mount Pleasant.
As part of a multi-billion dollar deal with the state, Foxconn was going to build the plant and provide nearly 13,000 manufacturing jobs in exchange for significant tax breaks. Instead, they will focus on research and development.
Representative Gordon Hintz is the Democratic leader of the Wisconsin State Assembly. He represents the city of Oshkosh. Representative Hintz, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, great to be here.
Well, what was your reaction when you saw this reporting on what sounds like a change of plans for Foxconn?
Well, it was disappointing but not surprising. A lot of the concerns that we've had about the changing nature of this project, Foxconn's history of overpromising and underdelivering on projects around the world, and just the fact that it never really made economic sense, led us to this point where, a conclusion that a lot of us had reached a year and a half ago.
There will still be a Foxconn project, it sounds like, and Republicans are pointing out, hey, most of these economic incentives, they only kick in when the jobs are actually created. So we're not out that much, I guess, is the argument. What do you say to that?
Well, that is definitely a positive of it. I guess the thing that has been, the only thing that you really need to get right if you're going to go forward with a project that involves up to $4 billion potentially of taxpayer money is the transparency and accountability. Give us updates on what's really happening, what we can expect, and the fact that what was sold to us when the bill was signed into law, when the contract was signed, is nowhere close to what's happening now, yet they're still using the same job numbers, just tells me that they're not being forthright, and I think the taxpayers deserve better in Wisconsin.
One big change under the current plans, it sounds like instead of entry-level manufacturing jobs, this would be a lot more research and development jobs. People would presumably need to come in with different skills, more technical training. Does that concern you?
Well, no, it's just a different project. Again, when we voted on something, we were sold a plan that were manufacturing jobs, that were the production of large-scale LCD screens, the only U.S. plant in the country. And now we're talking about something totally different, but it's vague. Words like tech hub and innovation center don't really tell me anything. And given the shortage of labor and really the shortage of engineers nationally, we're going to want to know that this is a viable model going forward. I don't think anybody has any idea, including Foxconn, about just what's going to happen here.
You were just calling for transparency and accountability. Should the state be doing more to try to impose those things, I guess, on Foxconn?
Well, certainly the state should, but the state needs to ask it of Foxconn. I wrote a letter to the WEDC and Mark Hogan last August, and I got a quick response. And when I asked for that, those
those kind of answers. They said, look, Foxconn's a successful company. We're not here to tell them how to do their jobs. You know, if they say they're going to create these jobs, they will. And there was almost no interest, despite, you know, the fact that this model is just simply not viable due to labor costs. I mean, this idea that we're going to bring back this kind of manufacturing is just not economically feasible. I think the reality is you have a company whose goal was to evade tariffs on the goods that they export to the U.S. And so by getting a foothold here, they were able to avoid the same kind of tariffs that have impacted other industries. I'm not sure this was ever about jobs in Wisconsin.
Do you think that Foxconn, all in all, was a mistake? Should this deal not have happened in the first place?
Yes. I mean, we have spent 2 years putting all our eggs in one basket, shifting all of our economic focus to one company with a plan that was not economic viable, that had a horrible track record, and lost sight of the fact that it's education, infrastructure, and small business development that is the key to long-term economic growth, especially from what state government can do.
Talking to Democratic State Assembly Representative Gordon Hintz, Democratic leader in the Wisconsin State Assembly, looking at what looks like a substantial change of plans in the big Foxconn development project. Your Republican colleagues, a couple of the leaders, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Senate Republican leader Scott Fitzgerald, have suggested that the blame lies in part with Democratic Governor Tony Evers and a changed attitude toward taxes and the business climate in Wisconsin. What's your response to that?
Well, any time that you've bragged and boasts and it completely falls apart, I realize it's, you know, humiliating for them. But the defection of blame is so desperate on their part. Look, this was their plan. They own it. They're the ones who you know, went along with it. And quite frankly, in the lame duck session, they took control of the WEDC so they'd be able to continue to manage it. So shifting it to Governor Evers, even as the company said it was, they couldn't do this anywhere in the United States, you know, it's just them trying to deflect blame from an awful decision that they made.
A lot of the money involved in the incentive deal, as we mentioned, is based on job creation. People have pointed, though, toward some construction costs already in place, repurposing transportation money to make the roads point at Foxconn. Are you worried about some of the costs that have already hit the state and local governments?
Sure. I mean, the big dollars were in the incentives, and it's true that none of those have been doled out. But we do have sunk costs. And again, there's opportunity cost in terms of this has taken all of our focus. But the fact that we diverted money, or they, I should say, diverted transportation dollars, $134 million away from state projects to support local roads for Foxconn is going to cost us. And, you know, if I were a local taxpayer in that area of Mount Pleasant and Racine County, you know, I would feel a little shaky about the fact that they have committed so much resources with the expectation that a big plant creating increased land valuation, you know, would deliver the results they wanted. And I think that's a little shaky right now.
With this change of plans, is there anything you think needs to happen in the legislature? You and your Republican colleagues, do you think you need to change anything?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think there's language in the contract that really sort of made it flexible. And it's not that I'm not, you know, I don't recognize market changes, but if they're talking about an innovation center, I think you're talking about 300 or 500 employees, you know, for a completely different type of job. I guess, you know, right-sizing it and figuring out, you know, the best way to be accountable to taxpayers. And if the plan needs modification, the legislature will act. But I just think we need what is actually going to happen. If it's going to be smaller, let's get those details out there. But don't continue to tell me there's going to be 13,000 jobs when that's not tied to anything. It does a disservice to taxpayers and really a disservice to Foxconn and they're, you know, trying to appeal to us.
Finally, what is your message for Foxconn itself? What kind of things do you want to hear from them that will make you feel more comfortable about this project going forward?
Let's have a reality-based plan with details about what is actually viable for the market that we're in and be a little more specific about what we can expect. I mean, managing expectations would make it a lot easier to support what they're going forward with, and we just haven't had that.
Representative Hintz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Representative Gordon Hintz is the Democratic leader of the Wisconsin State Assembly. He represents the city of Oshkosh. He joined us to talk about Foxconn's decision to focus on research and development at its plant in Mount Pleasant instead of manufacturing.
And coming up on Monday at about 3:45, we'll get a Republican take on Foxconn from Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke.
Rob Ferret here with Darrell Connor. Darrell has been on with me on and without me now on Central Time for the last couple of months. Now I have some bad news and, more importantly, some good news. Bad news is this is the end of Darrell's stint on Central Time. Good news, you'll hear Darrell on lots of other shows on this network and our other one and back here on Central Time. Darrell, it's been a lot of fun.
It has been a blast, and I want to take this opportunity to thank you, Rob, and the entire Central Time staff and crew for just welcoming me with open arms, being a part of your meetings, and getting me acclimated to Wisconsin Public Radio. I've really enjoyed it.
And your job now is going to be the fill-in host for us here on Central Time.
Yes.
Larry Mueller, that'll happen, the morning show, and over on the other side of the glass, Morning Edition. And that's the thing. I never get to listen to that because I'm on during it. So it's a job that has a lot of different hats.
It's a lot. It's going to take a lot to get used to. certainly getting used to things here and then moving on to Larry's show and then to the morning show and then others, just getting used to the way they do things. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to coming back and substituting for you from time to time.
I need some time off. I'll talk to you after the show.
Yeah, we'll talk.
And what's fun is I used to do that job. What's fun is just kind of, you know, stop and go on that morning show. It's like I'm getting up at 9, I'm getting up at 4:30 in the morning.
Right.
Yeah. That'll be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Even earlier for that other one. Yeah.
Yes.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.